From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ben Stiller. He's the son of the comedy team Stiller and Mira, and he's gone into the family business. He's starring in his own TV comedy series, which premieres Sunday night on Fox. His sketches parody MTV, arrogant rock stars, oversexed commercials, and wheeler-dealer agents. Also, we meet the writer and director of the award-winning film Europa, Europa. Agnieszka Holland's new film, Olivier, Olivier, opens the New York Film Festival tonight. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Tom Waits' new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush began a campaign trip through the Midwest in Chicago today, where he addressed a group of Motorola executives and employees. He took credit for opening up new markets and portrayed his opponent, Bill Clinton, as a protectionist. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The president used Motorola as an example of how his administration has helped to sharpen American competitiveness by expanding foreign markets. Exports to Japan have grown 12 times faster than imports, Mr. Bush said, and you're a fundamental part of this. Motorola is among the nation's 50 largest industrial companies ranked by sales. It depends largely on government contracts. Continuing a week-long broadside against his opponent, Mr. Bush accused Governor Clinton of promoting an industrial policy designed by a government elite.
I think that is absolutely wrong, and you have demonstrated that it's wrong. They say government knows best. I say private industry knows better.
The choice in the fall is between the architects of the future and the patrons of the past, Mr. Bush said, casting himself as the candidate of change, a mantle that has proven to be difficult for the incumbent to wrest away from his challenger. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Chicago.
Bill Clinton said today that President Bush is aiming his criticism at an imaginary opponent in trying to portray him as a so-called tax-and-spend liberal. Clinton began a two-day campaign swing through New England today with an effort to present himself as a moderate who can act when real government intervention is needed. Clinton derided President Bush as a do-nothing executive who sat idly by as millions of Americans lost jobs and health insurance. The Democratic candidate also mocked the president for refusing to debate. Clinton currently leads in all 8 states of New England, which represent a total of 79 electoral votes of the 270 needed for victory. The Russian Foreign Ministry announced today that in connection with an agreement reached with the United States, it's lifting all travel restrictions on American journalists and businessmen in Russia. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
According to today's announcement, American journalists and businessmen will be able to travel throughout Russia to any location that Russians are free to visit. The only restrictions are to those places that are off-limits to all. Earlier this year, the Russian government designated some military sites and areas engaged in nuclear weapons research as restricted. In recent years, American journalists working in Moscow were required to inform the Russian Foreign Ministry of their travel plans. That will no longer be necessary. In the darkest days of the Cold War, travel was severely restricted. The Russian government has taken this measure in tandem with a similar step taken by the U.S. government. At their summit in June, Russian President Boris Yeltsin and President Bush signed an agreement to lift mutual travel restrictions. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 37 points to close at 3,150. Declines led advances by 2-1. This is NPR. The Los Angeles Times quoted sources close to Ross Perot today saying the Texas billionaire will return to his presidential campaign on Monday. The newspaper said that Perot is likely to make his announcement on CNN's Larry King Live show, the same place he launched his original presidential bid last winter. Perot associates reportedly say that Perot has told them he's reluctantly returning to the race because neither President Bush nor Bill Clinton is addressing economic problems. Some analysts said that Perot could draw significant numbers of voters away from both candidates. The nation's space agency has begun a 2-year mission to study the planet Mars. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA's $511 million Mars Observer spacecraft is well on its way to the solar system's red planet. The Mars spacecraft left the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station atop a Titan III rocket. Despite an electrical problem that delayed liftoff by more than 30 minutes, NASA reports all went well with the launch. There was a tense moment for mission controllers, however. Shortly after reaching orbit, NASA was unable to communicate with the spacecraft to confirm its position and its separation from its new booster. The tiny rocket is attached to the Observer and is designed to propel the craft toward Mars. It's the first time NASA has used the transfer orbit stage. This is also the first trip to Mars for the United States since the Viking program of the mid-1970s. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
About 4,200 members of the United Auto Workers Union walked off the job today at a General Motors plant in Lansing, Michigan. The workers went on strike early this morning after talks broke down over work rules, job security, and other issues. A key issue appears to be GM's decision to eliminate about 300 jobs at the plant by altering the way employees take their breaks. The Lansing plant makes bodies for GM's second best-selling car, the Pontiac Grand Am. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi, I'm Ben Stiller. Welcome to the show. I guess you're wondering who I am and what the show's about. Well, I don't know. I've never really had a show before. It's my first time. It's a comedy thing. You know, we do lots of little funny films, hopefully funny. I don't know. We got to start it up. So I don't know. Anybody have any ideas on how to start the show? Anybody have anything?
You can see what Ben Stiller did come up with when his new comedy show premieres this Sunday night at 7:30 on Fox. In the meantime, here's a little preview. Stiller sketches lampoon MTV, movies, television, commercials, and confessional video journals. Stiller plays a young but already pretentious Bono in the rockumentary U2 The Early Years. There's a parody of those sleek, sexy, and absurdly arty ads for jeans and perfumes, but this ad is for Wilson Garden Hoses, available at your local hardware store. And Stiller does a remake of Cape Fear, only this is Cape Munster, in which an angry Eddie Munster seeks revenge against the TV executive who canceled his show and ruined his career. Stiller, of course, stars as Eddie Munster. Comedy was the family business when Stiller was growing up. His parents are the comedy team of Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. I asked Ben Stiller if he watches a lot of TV.
I watch way too much television, Terry. I did when I was a kid, and so now this is just a way for me to try to make a living with no formal training in any other field.
Right.
So I'm just kind of, it's definitely been an influence on me. So, I enjoy, I think there are a lot of things to make fun of on television. So.
Yeah, I want to get to one of the visual details in the Bono documentary. You have him, it's the early year, so you have him doing a breakfast cereal commercial.
Right, a commercial for Lucky Clover cereal.
Yeah, and you're combining two completely different languages in the commercial. Because you have like the upbeat breakfast cereal kind of language, and since it's Lucky Clovers, there's a little dancing leprechaun. But of course, because it's Bono, there's all this like MTV rock video stuff happening too. So there's a scene where he's eating a cereal, and there's a buffalo surrealistically walking across the frame, and a beautiful woman walking across the frame.
Yeah,
so you've really gotten the language down.
Well, you know, videos, it's just like there's no rules in these videos, and there's so many pretentious videos out there that...
Yes, thank you.
You know,
it's so true.
So why not? You know, what we did was, with that one, with the Lucky Clovers, you two doing the Lucky Clovers commercials, we took... There are three different videos, which I think is funny also, that U2 did three videos for their song One.
Mm-hmm.
As if, you know, one wasn't enough, they had to do three pretentious videos. I mean, I like U2, too. I know that sounds like I'm contradicting myself, but I really love their music. But there was, you know, there's one where it's just a buffalo. Did you ever see that? There's just buffaloes running around in a field. Like buffaloes in slow motion, buffaloes, paintings of buffaloes, every different buffalo, permutation you can imagine. So we took that one. Then there's one where they're sitting in that black and white one in Berlin where they're in drag, which we also did. And then there's the one where he's just at this table singing to the camera. So we kind of combined all of those and then tried to put a little bit of a twist on it by just, throwing in the idea that they're doing a commercial for cereal, which I don't think you'd ever see you two doing. So
in one of the sketches, you play a Hollywood agent who's trying to get his clients, like Roseanne and Tom Arnold and Gary Shandling, to make disease movies.
Let's get serious. Come on, you guys are too good for comedy. I mean, let's do a disease, all right? Tom, you get sick. Rosie, you come and take care of him. Rosie, you get sick, Tom takes care of you. I mean, I don't care. It works both ways. You both get sick, you die, you fall in love, whatever, right? You're the creative ones. You can figure it out.
We're beginning to feel like maybe you're not the right agent for us.
What? This is a bit, right? Doing a thing? I love it. All right, keep going. Come on.
You haven't done crap for us.
All right. Where's the punch? Oh, come on, Rosie. Come on. What do you want? You're number one. Where else can we go?
The show was number one when we hired you.
Whew. This weight loss thing is really playing with your heads, guys. I mean, really, is this the Slim Shake talking? Because if it is, let's go across the street, let's get a cheeseburger, fries, fried chicken, load it up and eat it, because nothing is worth this, all right? Let's face it, the diet is killing your careers. Fat is funny. You go back in time, Greeks, Romans, in the tub, rub-a-dub-lub, three men having fun.
Is this based on an agent that you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, he's my my ex-agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's, yeah. In 5 years, I had him, and he wasn't a bad guy. He actually worked really, really hard for me, and this is how I pay him back.
So, is this why he's your ex-agent?
Yeah, it is. He threatened to sue me. Actually, he made me if I made the name too similar to his. But yeah, you know, all agents have a certain amount of. I don't know what it is, like a kind of a bull factor, I guess. They're always kind of blowing smoke at you, and it's a really strange profession. You know, they're just, it's all hype and keeping actors, you know, thinking that, you know, you're finding work for them when you're really just, you know, kind of going out there and trying to drum up work for them. It's just like, they're all, and then they'll kind of change with the wind on you a lot of the time, too. You know, if you say something, you know, you say, oh, you know, would you like a movie will come out and they'll like be, oh, it was great. And then it won't do well and they'll be, yeah, you know, well, it was all right. It wasn't really, you know, you don't want to do that. It's just, they talk in circles. And this guy kind of just talks around and around. He'll be pitching horrible ideas. You know, you should do a sitcom. You know, you could be doing a thing with Bea Arthur. You know, it's you and her and she's, you know, she lives next door and she's gruff and you're, you know, you're crazy, but you like her, but you don't like her. And then all of a sudden something happens. You teach each other how to love. It's beautiful, you know? And, you know, he just kind of, he always deal in concepts, you know.
Did you ever try to go along with him on one of these ideas and really get your hopes up that you were going to do this sitcom with Bea Arthur and teach each other how to love?
Yeah, for 5 years. I was just calling me up with these ideas. And then, like, then when I started directing, he would, like, call me up with these just things that he'd never, totally untrue. It would be like, you want to direct, he goes, you want to direct Ice Cube's new video? I go, I don't know. You know, I'm like a Jewish kid from New York. You really think he wants me? He goes, yeah, well, I'll talk to him about it. You know, the only thing is you got to go to Compton every day, but you could deal with that, right? Meanwhile, he's never even, he never even talked to him. He'd always be throwing out stuff like that. So you learn to kind of not take it too seriously after a while and just kind of take notes so that you can use it down the line on your own show, hopefully, you know?
You
can do something productive with it.
Is it hard to break up with an agent? Did you feel very guilty about it?
Yeah, it is, actually. It's really hard because you do develop a close relationship. Because, you know, an agent has your career in his hands, and actors are really insecure. And you're kind of always, you know, he's your link to the outside world. He's going to be taking all the offers or auditions that you go on. He gets the feedback, and he tells you, and he has to kind of sift it through to you without... You know, kind of dealing with that fragile ego that actors have. So he's your link, and if you develop a bond with him in some way, because it's kind of like this codependent relationship that develops, you know, where you really need to you need the approval, and so when it finally comes time to change, it's like breaking up with a girlfriend or something like that, because you know there are always aspects that you really like about the person, but you also know that you have to move on. So it's not easy. It's not fun to do, especially when you know it's been a few years and you've been working with someone for a long time. There's loyalty questions, all that stuff.
When you told him you were going to find somebody else, did he try to convince you to stay?
Oh, of course. He just went into a whole thing. He said, "You're going to hate him." He knew. He goes, "All right, you'll be back." He goes, "You'll be back. Look, you know, good luck." And actually, my first agent who I left, yeah, that's what he said to me. He said, "You'll be back in a year," and that was like 7 years ago. And then I went to the next guy, and he said, you know, good luck, and, you know, I really think you're making a mistake, this guy. And they started telling me stories about the guy. You know, I mean, but you know what? He was all out of really wanting to I think he really felt like he wanted, you know, he believed in me and he wanted to me to give him another shot. But, you know, it was just kind of, you know, you have a sense about that in when you're, you know, in what you do when it's time to make a decision like that. And it's not easy. No.
It sounds like there should be special agents whose job it is to represent you when you're breaking up with your own agent. So, because this is the one place where you've got nobody to represent you.
That's what your manager is for.
Oh, I see.
They deal with your agent.
Okay.
They tell you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ben Stiller, and he has a new comedy series that premieres this Sunday at 7:30 on Fox. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ben Stiller is with me, and his new program starts this Sunday night on Fox. Your parents are Jerry Stiller and Mira.
No, that's not them. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes.
That's another Stiller.
Right.
No, I'm sorry.
So were there lots of showbiz people around the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, there were. It was kind of, it was a crazy, crazy household. It was Rodney Dangerfield would come over for Thanksgiving. Andy Kaufman came over. And have chocolate milk at Passover. Weird things.
When you were growing up, were your parents in the kitchen working out routines?
And yeah, they were in the living room. Actually, they were. They had an office in the living room, and they would close the door, and we would hear them working on their routines. It was. And my dad had this reel-to-reel tape recorder. I used to love gadgets and stuff, and I just thought he had this great reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I was about 7 or 8, and all I could think of was, when my parents die, I'm going to inherit this tape recorder. That was all. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
What were you going to do with it?
I was going to make my own tapes and, you know, probably like record soundtracks to movies, you know, because I made Super 8 films. And they would go in there and they would work on their stuff. And, you know, they'd take us on the road with them when they would go and do Las Vegas or go out to California.
Oh, boy. Share with us a memory of being on the road with your parents when they were doing Las Vegas.
Okay, let's see. Well, there was, we spent a lot of time in motels, and I remember my folks, they worked with people like Lola Falana, and, you know, they were, you know, they had their brushes with like Frank Sinatra and people like that. I never met him, but there was also a lot of time hanging out on sets. Like, my parents took us on the Partridge Family set in California, and,
Now, was that a thrill, or did you think, oh, this is, what an absurd show?
No. I was totally into it, you know? I mean, I thought this is, you know, so cool. Danny Bonaducci was, like, kind of flirting with my sister, which is funny now in retrospect. But, my parents did The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Do you remember that show?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember Brandon Cruz, who was Eddie on the show, came up to me, and we were about the same age, and I had this candy bar, and he just knocked it out of my hand. Like in this kind of show of his power on the set to kind of just establish who was the boss on the set. And then he walked away from me. I'll never forget that one.
How did you feel?
I felt small. I was just kind of shocked, I think. You know, I didn't know, you know, who this guy was. But, you know, that was kind of tempered by Bobby Brady waving to me from the stagecoach when they were doing the Grand Canyon episode. You know, and that's real. I mean, that's true. So,
making you feel like you were really somebody.
That's right. It kind of brought me back up again.
So did your friends' parents work in show business too?
I had some friends whose parents were in show business. But, you know, we grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it was it's not like a typical environment. It's not like suburbia, and it's not middle America at all. And I think, you know, I never really knew what a normal environment was like. I thought when I finally kind of got out of New York a little bit, I was kind of fascinated by the suburbs. I went to do a movie like 5 years ago in Cincinnati, and I just thought it was the most amazing place in the world, because it was like, here are all these like houses that I'd seen in commercials, you know. I met this girl. I started going out with this girl there, and I think I was more into her family, which, you know, they had a dog and she had a little brother, and her father was like Mr. All-American. He'd been in the Air Force and he played football, and they, you know, it just was like, this is America. And I felt like kind of this like little spy, and you know, kind of seeing what the rest of the country lived like. So it was really an interesting experience for me. So, but it kind of wore off after a while.
When there were showbiz people around the house, would you feel comfortable talking with them?
It was, I guess so. I mean, I didn't really consider them showbiz people, though. You know, it was more like they were just my parents' friends. You know, those were the people who they hung out with and who were, and we were around the theater a lot, and we were, you know, that was just kind of our life. So it wasn't like, you know, I remember when my dad did this play Hurley Burley a few years back. I was about, I think, 18, 17 or 18, and that had like this cast of, like, William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver and Judith Ivey and just like, you know, Ron Silver, Harvey Keitel. It was just this great cast. And I remember hanging out, you know, at that point we were older, but these were like people who were more from like, you know, movie stars from my generation, you know, who my dad was working with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very kind of exciting for my sister and I at that point, because we were kind of young and we were just getting into the business. And, you know, to be hanging out with William Hurt, I was like, you know, a big Altered States fan. And my dad, like, invited him up to our country house and he went fishing with him. So I'm like, fishing with William Hurt. And he's really, you are unique. And he's telling me that.
He's telling you.
He was telling me. He was telling me. Yeah, he was really intense. He would just get really intense. The fish aren't biting. And he would just get very intense about whatever he talked about. And so I was just freaking out. I was having a great time. You know, this is so cool.
What were your early stabs of becoming a performer?
I always wanted to make the films. That's what I always wanted to do since I was like, you know, 11 or 12. And
yeah, you said you had a Super 8. What did you do with that?
Oh, I made all sorts of mainly murder movies.
Uh-huh.
Called like, they called it Murder, I think was the first one. Murder in the Park. We did Airport 75, I remember, where I turned the foyer into an airplane, and then I took a model of a 747 and stuck some matches in the cockpit and lit them, and then put the airplane up to the window and filmed it. And then I took the same airplane and I had this diorama that I built for my train set with mountains, and I crashed the airplane into the side of the mountain and burned my whole train set. So I do those, make a lot of those films. I always like experimenting with special effects and stuff like that. And then as I got older, I thought, okay, I'm going to be an actor first and then go into filmmaking that way. For some reason, I guess I just wanted to perform also. So, and I thought I was going to be a serious actor for a long time. Like when I was about 18, I thought, you know, because I grew up with comedy, I was kind of rebelling against the whole thing. And I said, I'm going to be serious, you know. And that, what happened was somehow it came out. The other stuff started to come out. I started to, I got a job doing this play, House of Blue Leaves. And while we were doing that, it was a long run. We ran at Lincoln Center for about a year. And then we moved theaters in the middle. But it was a long run. Everybody got to know each other very well. And I had this home video camera. So I started making little documentaries and behind-the-scenes shorts about, you know, the cast. And we did this one about John Mahoney, who you said you had on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, we called it Portrait of the Artist as an Old Man. And it was just kind of this seedy look at his backstage life, where he was kind of this alcoholic, womanizing lech. And we did interviews with everybody in the cast, like Danny Aiello and Julie Haggerty and Susie Kurtz, everybody talking about how John was, you know, he's just like the, you know, this horrible guy. And then, I mean, I even got John to lay down in the gutter with a wino bag underneath his poster for saying Tony Award winning House of Blue Leaves. It's the funniest shot. And he was great. And so that to me, and then I showed that at a New Year's Eve party for the whole cast, and everybody laughed. And it was, of course, it was a really friendly, you know, audience. But that kind of made me think, hey, I could do this. This could be really fun. And then from that, I started making some more short films. And I did a takeoff on The Color of Money that was about bowling instead of pool when that movie came out. And I sold that to Saturday Night Live. And that was really encouraging. And then that just kind of started the ball rolling, you know. I just said, okay, I'm going to go for it and, you know, do this type of thing.
I like what you said before, that originally you were rebelling against comedy and you were going to be serious.
Yeah.
It's a kind of interesting notion, rebelling against comedy.
I know. Well, that's all I had to rebel against.
Yeah, really.
My parents, you know, they didn't beat me. They were you know, very nice and supportive. And, you know, that's kind of tough to deal with also. It's like, what do you rebel against? So I wanted to be really serious.
Did you ever do stand-up?
No. But we do takeoffs on stand-up comedians on the show a lot. Like we do on the first show, we do this Yakov Smirnov thing.
Oh, yeah. What happens to Yakov Smirnov after the end of the Cold War?
Right, the idea is that he has no act left, so he's just doing a lot of jokes about former Soviet Union. In former Soviet Union, we used to have no freedom. Now we have freedom. What a sovereignty of independent nations. I love it. And he's just bombing, just going nowhere. So he starts, like, grasping for straws. In Soviet Union, we used to have KGB. Now we have KFC. Kentucky Fried Chicken. that Yakov laugh. And then he really starts grasping for straws. And he's like, did I ever tell you I am part Chinese, which is still communist country? In China, you have food. An hour later, you want freedom. And then just, he turns into this nightmare. He starts going, I wish communism would come back. I am cold. I am frightened. What will New World Order bring for Yakov?
You think you'll be hearing from him?
I don't know. I'm sure I'll be hearing from his lawyers. It's unnecessarily cruel. But I got to tell you, I saw him driving down Sunset Boulevard in a red Ferrari with license plate X Red, and he was just like smiling on his car phone. I thought, okay, forget it. No, I just can't. All right, anyway, I won't say anything more.
So now that you have a TV show, when you watch TV, do you see it differently? You know, because as someone who's watched TV a lot all of his life?
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, what I see is just it's really tough to put out a half hour of comedy that you believe in, you know, you think is really funny every week. You have so much to film in such a short amount of time. You're always working against the clock and budget constraints. So it's not easy. You know what's tough, too, is getting on the air. I don't think people understand how tough it is to actually get to a show that's picked up for a series. Like, you know, we developed this show for a couple of years, and, you know, the networks are just, you know, they make a lot of decisions based on demographics and focus groups and all these, you know, factors, and there are so many pilots that are made. And you know, a lot of them stink, and you know, but there are a lot of good ones, too, I think, that get made and then don't get picked up. So I feel really lucky that we even got to this point where we're on the air.
Are you a survivor of focus groups?
Oh, I went to the focus group for my own show. It was like this surreal high school nightmare to stand behind a two-way mirror and watch people talk about you for 4 hours and criticize you. And all they do is
and
ask...
And who are they?
Who are they? Yeah, well, who are they? That's, you know what? It was the strangest amalgam of, like, you know who they are? They're people. They go to a mall and they say, do you like Herman's Head? And if they say yes, and they say, do you want $35 and a free sandwich? And then that's the criteria. That's it. And then they come up to the room and then they judge, you know, and they pass judgment, which the network takes very seriously on what you've been working on. You know, you've been, you know, putting your whole life into it. And then these people come in and you're in the middle, it's in the middle of, you know, your big piece on the show. And they're like going over to try to get another carrot stick, you know, and you think, no, just watch it. And they're all different funny types in there, and just they all claim that they don't know anything about, you know, about show business. So they're all like, well, you know, one guy's a mechanic, but then he's saying, you know, I think the protagonist was rather weak in the first act. And they have all got screenplays, you know, it's because they do it. They did ours outside of Los Angeles, so it was, it was pretty wild to sit through that. After that, I thought I could, you know, I feel like I could deal with anything.
Ben Stiller, good luck with your show.
Thanks, Terry.
And thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right, it was fun. Thanks.
The Ben Stiller Show premieres this Sunday night at 7:30 on Fox. Here's Stiller from his parody, You Two, The Early Years. The band is playing a bar mitzvah. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
And I hope everybody's ready to dance the horror and the hokey pokey soon. I don't want to see anybody sitting. Let's give him a hand, Joel. Yeah, today Joel is a man. Okay, Edge. Play the blues!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The New York Film Festival opens tonight with a new work by Agnieszka Holland. She's best known as the writer and director of Europa Europa, a World War II film about a young German Jew who passes as a Christian and ends up in the Hitler Youth Corps. Coming up, we talk with Holland about how her own family survived the war. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Tom Waits' new album, Bone Machine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A judge in Florida has granted the wish of a 12-year-old boy to divorce his biological parents and be adopted by his foster parents. The child had testified that his biological parents had mistreated and abandoned him. The youngster had filed suit in what has been called a divorce case and testified that while he doesn't hate his mother, he has come to believe that she doesn't care about him. He told the court that he wants to be adopted by his foster parents because he wants to be happy. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton started a campaign sweep through New England today, stopping first in Hartford before heading on to an evening rally in Boston. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
An estimated 45,000 people crowded into a space outside Boston's Faneuil Hall this evening to hear Clinton's sharp-tongued attack on President Bush's record. Clinton took Mr. Bush to task for vetoing the family leave bill this week and for refusing to debate him in Michigan, saying the president has run out of ideas and out of time.
He gets in an airplane and he flies around my state and tells everybody how bad Arkansas is. Now, if he really believes that, of course, he could come and debate me and I could answer him.
Clinton shared the stage with his past rival, former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas. The Arkansas governor heads to Manchester, New Hampshire tomorrow, where he's scheduled to address a state Democratic convention. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
President Bush has been campaigning in the Midwest, where he said that recent allegations by retired Major General Richard Secord about the president's information on the Iran-Contra affair were all speculation on his part. Secord, who has written a book about Iran-Contra, says that then-Vice President Bush knew about arms sales to Iran than he has conceded. More than 4,000 General Motors workers went out on strike in Lansing, Michigan today. Roger Adams of Michigan Public Radio reports.
United Auto Workers Local 602 has been trying for months to get management at the Lansing Car Assembly Plant to address what it says are unsafe working conditions on the line. The plant has laid off relief employees who fill in for workers while on break. The result, according to Local 602's Dick Bennett, is work overloads and more injuries.
You don't have time for your body to recuperate from whatever stressors there are in many instances. That's not to say every job's that way, but we have a number of jobs that we just can't accept being that way.
General Motors will not comment on the union's allegations. Workers say they are prepared for a long strike because the company has a 60-day supply of cars already built. However, ripple effects are expected in other Michigan plants that supply parts to Lansing. For National Public Radio, I'm Roger Adams.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 37 points to close at 3,250. This is NPR News. The Senate, by a vote of 58-36, has turned down a White House plan to allow taxpayers to earmark 10% of their tax bill for the national debt. Under this measure, taxes designated to cut the national debt would have to be offset by cuts in other spending programs. A key supporter of the plan said it could balance the federal budget in 5 years' time. But West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd said not only will the national debt be eliminated, but so will all government programs. The South African government has announced President F.W. de Klerk and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela will meet tomorrow. The government also said it will release a number of political prisoners over the next few days. From Johannesburg, Tom Carver, the BBC, reports.
President de Klerk's announcement that he was releasing a number of political prisoners came only minutes after both sides had agreed to hold their summit tomorrow morning. It's clearly intended as a peace offering to the ANC to get the constitutional talks restarted. The president said that an unspecified number of prisoners would be released in the coming days and weeks. We must close the book on the past, he said, not selectively but fully. However, it's unclear just how comprehensive his offer is, whether it includes the three ANC members who were convicted of murder and whose release the government had initially objected to. It has taken 18 days of talks between the two sides' negotiators for tomorrow's meeting to become possible. This is a worrying sign and suggests that the longer this negotiation process takes, the more stumbling blocks there'll be.
Tom Carver in Johannesburg. Magic Johnson has resigned from the National Commission on AIDS, charging that the Bush administration has ignored the disease. In a letter to the president, Johnson said he is afraid that there is little that can be done in the fight against AIDS over the next 4 months. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The New York Film Festival opens tonight with a new work by Agnieszka Holland called Olivier, Olivier. Holland is best known to Americans as the writer and director of last year's art house hit Europa, Europa. This was a moving story about a Holocaust survivor, but it's also an absurd and often comic tale about identity. Set during World War II, it's the story of a young German Jew who flees to the Soviet Union and ends up in a communist orphanage singing communist anthems. When he's captured by the invading German army, he passes himself off as a Christian. He's so successful at his charade, he winds up in an elite Hitler youth school. Holland says she identifies with this constant shifting of identity. She is a Polish Jew who lives in France and has made films in Poland, Germany, and England. Europa, Europa was the most commercially successful German-language film since Das Boot and won several awards in America. But the German committee that chooses Oscar entries for Best Foreign Language Film didn't select it, saying that its Polish director and French co-financing disqualified it. Many Americans interpreted this as German reluctance to be reminded of the past, but Holland says it was more than that.
They have done, the German filmmakers have done some movies about the Holocaust, but I think that it was difficult for German to accept this vision of the Holocaust. In some way, the fact that it was, you know, different for, of the accepted image of the Holocaust, it was offended for them. Paradoxically, it was some arguments in German press that the movie is anti-Semitic because show the Jew who is not dead enough, you know. I think that they can accept the very pathetic vision of the Jew if this Jew is dead, but it's much more difficult to accept a life and normal Jew.
You've made two films that I know of that had to do with the Holocaust, Europa, Europa, and then a film called Korczak, which you co-wrote and which was directed by Andrzej Wajda. And Korczak was about a Jewish doctor in Poland who ran a Jewish orphanage and tried to keep his children fed and protected from the Nazis during the war. Did you ever think you would make movies related to World War II and to the Holocaust, or was that a subject that in a way you wanted to avoid because of the number of films that had been made about it?
I have done one movie before also, directed by myself, called Angry Harvest, which was presented at New York Film Festival a couple of years ago. I was nominated for the Academy Award a couple of years ago. It was the story of two people during the Holocaust, a young Jewish woman and the Catholic peasant who had a very strange relationship between them. It was quite a good movie. And I think that it's over for me. I hope that I have done what I can to do about the subject, and now I prefer don't touch it. It's too, you know, it's very difficult. When I spent, for example, when I wrote Korczak, and after I have done The Angry Harvest, I had the impression that I spent too long time in the kind of the ghetto, you know, and I was so tired morally after that. I told it, it's never more. Europa was paradoxically was easier, maybe because this lighter lighting, but I can't tell for the future. If I find something which is really new for myself about the subject, it's a very important subject for me, and I think it's the subject which reflects in some way, you know, the situation of the humanity, not only Jewish story or German story, but the human story in general.
You were born, I believe, right after World War II. 1948 was the year?
Yeah.
Okay. What did your parents experience during the war in Poland?
My father was a Jew, and he escaped, and he was communist also, and he escaped as a very young man and as a student, 18 years old. He escaped to Soviet Union on the beginning of the war, and he spent all war there. He was in Soviet and after Polish army in Soviet Union, and he came with the Polish army after the liberation. All his family, except one sister, died in Warsaw Ghetto. He was only survivor. And my mother, she was from Polish Catholic family. She was a very young girl during the war, and she was in Polish resistance army as a teenager. And they met after the war, after they divorced, after my father, who was a journalist and scientific, was arrested in 61 in Poland, and he died during the interrogation in very mysterious circumstances. We don't know till now if he was killed or if it was suicide. And my mother is still alive. She was the journalist all her life, and she's a fantastic woman, and that's it, my family.
I think a lot of Jewish survivors left Eastern Europe when the war was over, or never returned if they left during the war. Do you know why your father decided to go back to Poland?
I think that in this time he felt to be more Polish communist than Jew, you know. It was the communism in some way was the reaction of the fascism and antisemitism, you know, in Poland and in Germany. And a lot of them, in some way, like Sally in my movie Europa, Europa, cut the roots, and they didn't feel to be Jewish, but by conviction or by the religion, they felt to be the kind of the cosmopolitan family of, you know, of the leftist people. And I think that was the reason why my father didn't want to emigrate. He wanted to construct the communism in Poland. And after some years, when he had seen what's happened, he was very disappointed and very unhappy, and in some way he tried to fight against this vision of the communism, which was practical, and it was the reason why he died also.
Growing up after the war in a family with a Catholic mother who was in the resistance and a Jewish father, did you feel yourself to be Jewish? Did you feel strongly Jewish? Is that an important part of your identity?
It changed in my life. I think that by the culture, by the language, and by the education, I'm mostly Polish. But my mother was very, very interested by Jewish culture and Jewish destiny, and she was deeply touched by Holocaust. And it was by her that I learned that I'm Jew and what it means. My father never spoke about it when I was a child. And after, when I grown up, I started to be interested about the Jewish philosophy and religion and history. And now I think that I can tell that I'm really half-half. It means that the big part of myself which is Jewish and big part which is not.
My guest is screenwriter and director Agnieszka Holland. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter and director Agnieszka Holland, and she directed Europa Europa and the new film Olivier Olivier. You collaborated on several films with Andrzej Wajda, one of Poland's leading film directors, and you worked on Man of Marble and Man of Iron, and I believe both of those were filmed during the Solidarity Movement.
Second one was,
mm-hmm. Okay. How did you were a member of the collective that he headed. You were a member of that group from 1972 to 1981. Mm-hmm. What did it mean to be a member of that?
You know, it was the kind of the production unit, which was quite special for the Polish structure of the filmmaking, because every money was the state money, and after it was the kind of the collectives of the units, directed mostly by the well-known director. And it grouped the writers and filmmakers, and it was the kind of the Vajda was the kind of the producer of my movie, but he didn't finance it. It was the state who financed it, but he developed the subject and fought it with the censorship and organized the production process.
What was the impact of the Solidarity movement on you as a filmmaker?
I have done one movie during the Solidarity time. It was called Woman Alone, and in some way it was the reaction on the optimism of my colleagues. I found them too optimistic. You know, I felt that the solidarity, it's not something which can resolve the problems. I was very pessimistic, and after the martial law came, and in some way I was unfortunately right. But it was very strong movement, you know. It was for many people, it was really the first experience of this kind of the collective freedom. And for me, not so much, because I had it in Czechoslovakia during my study, during the Prague Spring, which was also the beautiful period. Some months was great.
Oh, you were there in Czechoslovakia during Prague Spring?
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing?
I studied there. I spent 5 years in Czechoslovakia.
What were your experiences like during that spring?
But it was the most important period of my life. In some ways, I was very young, and you know, I learned the cinema, and I learned the life, and I married, and I made the political experience. I had also the problems. I was in the prison. I have the political trial, and I have done my first student movies. You know, it was great.
What were you in prison for?
For the political reasons.
Because
after Russian intervention.
Because of participating in a demonstration, because of
no,
a
because
movie
I wanted to organize with some of my Polish friends a kind of the underground press or underground informations.
How long were you in prison?
Some weeks. 6 weeks. Not so long.
What did you learn about yourself in prison?
Oh, that I'm strong. I was very proud of myself when I came, because I was alone during 3 weeks, and I can stand it to be alone, completely alone and isolated, which was very, very important human experience I have done. And I understand that in some way I'm free, because I can stand the situation like a prison.
Did you think of movies as being a good place to make statements that were political and cultural, you know, that would have a political and cultural impact on people?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think that the movie in 60s and 70s, the cinema was something much more important than today, certainly. And I'm quite skeptical about the impact of the films of the people. And today also, I never really liked the political cinema in the militant terms. What I try to tell in my films which touch the politics or history, that the life is very complicated, and know that it's black and white.
I'm not surprised to hear you say that. I think anybody who could get through the layers of absurdity that you do in movie wouldn't see things as black or white.
Hopefully.
Now, I forget whether you said it was Man of Marble or Man of Iron that was shot during the Solidarity movement.
Man of Iron.
I think that was a film that ended up being important to the Solidarity movement. Were you seen as kind of active participants in it or heroes during it because of the film?
I helped Andrzej to write the screenplay, to write the last version of the screenplay. But, this movie was very important. In some way, it was the most important movie about the solidarity. But I didn't like it so much. I found that it's exactly too black and white, you know. And that it takes a little the stylistics of the communist cinema from 50s, but show the reality in a different way. But today, when I am watching this movie, I am very touched, you know, and I am very pleased that it, in some way, it's the documentary of our illusions.
Documentary of your illusions.
Yeah.
Which illusions?
That if you, you, that you can really win, you know, that it's if you win with the communists, everything will be better and simple and nice and full of light, you know, and life. And today, when the communism is over, you see that the situation is much more complicated, and that the evil is not only in the political system, but inside of the human soul.
You've been living and working in several countries. I mean, you're from Poland. You studied in Czechoslovakia. You made Europa Europa in Germany. Your latest film was made in France, where you've been living. You're making a movie now, I believe, in America. Looking at Europe for a moment, is the Maastricht Treaty and would that have an effect on you as a filmmaker?
I hope that the unification of Europe will happen, but it's not sure yet. Unfortunately, the meaning of the people and the courage of the people to do something like that changed recently, and recently the political and moral situation in Europe is not so, and economical also, it's not so good. I think that the unification of Europe is something which will be really good for everybody. And in the terms of the filmmaking, unfortunately, European cinema is the deep crisis. And you can see it in post-communist countries, that only movie you can watch them, it's big American movies, which is a little pity, because I think that the cultural richness of the European cinema, of European culture in general, it's very important, that it will be pity also for American cinema if it will disappear.
Let's get back to something you were just saying before. You said that you really can't see things in black and white, not even the solidarity movement. You can see that in black and white, and that the human soul is really very complicated. Did you learn that at all through your parents' experiences, through watching them?
I think so, yes. I think by my parents, by myself, by my friends, you know, and also to working in different countries and to speaking to the people from different cultures. I think it's important to see that the world, you know, it's not so simple, and that in some way the experience of the exile, it's very difficult experience, but it can be very rich also.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Agnieszka Holland's new film, Olivier, Olivier, opens the New York Film Festival tonight. It's scheduled to open commercially in February. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what political stories do you have for us?
Well, Terry, Linda Wertheimer traveled to Michigan earlier this week, and she met with some students at Macomb Community College in Warren, Michigan. She'll have a report on how some of those young voters feel about this presidential election. And I'll be talking with two volunteers for Ross Perot. One now still supports him, but the other has decided that he would not vote for Ross Perot if Perot decides to enter the race. And we'll also have a conversation with Michael Mann, the director of the new film The Last of the Mohicans, that's opening today. We'll talk to him about the research that went into this historic period film.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tom Waits wrote the soundtrack for the recent Jim Jarmusch film, Night on Earth, but his new album, Bone Machine, is the first collection of his own songs since 1987. Waits has always cultivated the persona of a cool, dissolute hipster, but rock critic Ken Tucker says Bone Machine goes beyond that image.
In case you couldn't make out the opening quatrain of that new Tom Waits song, it was, "Well, I'm going out west where the wind blows tall, 'cause Tony Franciosa used to date my ma." This was one of my first clues that Bone Machine represents a welcome change in the Tom Waits we've known and grown bored with over the past two decades. After all these years of presenting himself as a Skid Row philosopher, a pretentious beatnik with a sentimental streak, Waits is gratifyingly energetic, tough-minded, and downright funny on Bone Machine. You've got to like a guy who tries to impress a woman, as he does a little later in that song, with the lines, "Well, I know karate, voodoo too. I'm going to make myself available to you." Throughout this album, it's as if Tom Waits has emerged from a long period of self-absorption and realizes he's interested in the world around him again.
There was a murder in the red barn, a murder in the red barn. The trees are bending over and the cows are lying down. The autumn's taking over, you can hear the buckshot hounds. The watchman said,
that's Murder in the Red Barn, Waits' version of a hard-boiled detective story as William Faulkner might have written it. Many of the songs on Bone Machine display Waits' gift for terse, blunt narrative, as well as a new interest in spiritual matters. An eerie song called All Stripped Down, for example, is the first time I've ever heard the ascension of one's soul into heaven sound like a scary, dangerous journey. Bone Machine isn't a great album. It's marred by the stuff that always slows up a Tom Waits record, hollow bluster and showy surrealism, and a love for the sound of his own craggy voice, as if it still doesn't sound like what it always has, a cross between Dr. John and Captain Beefheart. But the best music on Bone Machine represents a real breakthrough for Waits. Simple melodies, shredded pieces of the blues, pushed along by clattering percussion that sounds as if Waits and his friends are banging on garbage cans with hubcaps. This music, combined with a sense of humor as dry as his throat, gives Bone Machine a source of power that I hope Waits will tap into more often in the future.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Today we say goodbye to our top-notch, resourceful researcher, Ellen Silva. Our loss is Washington's gain. She's moving to NPR member station WAMU to produce the Derek McGinty Show. Good luck. We'll miss you. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of America's leading conservative thinkers. We talk with George Will. He's written a new book about reforming Congress. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.